Okay. Okay. So, as we mentioned, the Parsha Mishpatim begins with Jewish slavery, right, with Eved Ivri. It also discusses a little bit of Eved Kenani, right, the halach of Shein V'ayin, that a slave goes free if you blind his eye or knock out any limb, anything like that. And someone had asked me this in the question and answer, so I'll give it a little bit more justice now. This is an excellent article if you want to borrow it afterwards, or you could just take it. I just printed it. Slavery, all the slavery mitzvot, especially Eved Kenani, but even Eved Ivri to an extent, creates a lot of problems morally for most modern people who grew up on the notion that slavery is, you know, one of the greatest evils in the history of mankind. Rabbi Gamliel Shmalo put together a nice article in the Torah Mada Journal, basically analyzing how do modern thinkers deal with this, with the cognitive dissonance, right? That we live in a world where slavery is viewed as absolutely evil, and the Torah sort of swallows it, endorses it, whatever you want to say, right? And he notes that anti-religious thinkers, slavery is one of the things that they pick on to prove, quote-unquote, that religion is false, right? So like Hitchens, right? He starts off his article here with a quote from Hitchens, right? By this I mean the view that we ought to be glad that none of the religious myths has any truth to it or in it. The Bible may indeed does contain a warrant for trafficking in humans, for ethnic cleansing, for slavery, for bride price, and for indiscriminate massacre, but we are not bound by any of it because it was put together by crude, uncultured human mammals, right? This is like what, yeah, Hitchens has a way of, but the point being that this is one of the examples of mitzvot that really give people fodder in a context where most people, anti-slavery sentiments resonate with them, to attack the morality of the Torah and maybe even the divinity of the Torah. How do you deal with it? Again, morally speaking, Eved Ivri is much less of a problem because Eved Ivri is not really slavery, it's indentured servitude, which is slightly better to modern thinkers than slavery. Though it still creates some sort of tension, I think, for at least for some people. Eved Kenani, including the prohibition to free slaves, and the fact that it really is inherited, right? This really is lifetime slavery, and it's inherited by the children, and the children become slaves, is much closer to slavery, to real slavery. So how do you deal with it? So he outlines basically three approaches. Again, there is always the approach which he doesn't take, and he notes that, you know, because of the sort of universal taboo on slavery, even people who are not usually apologists do try to defend it. Well, you can always just say, though I'm not really comfortable with it, but there are definitely people in this world who are, which is, well, the Torah says it, so it's moral, and, you know, get the Modernish values out of your head, right? That's always possible. But as he notes, most thinkers, at least on the issue of slavery, did not take that approach because they really did, the modern anti-slavery moral really did resonate with them. So, the first approach that he highlights is what he calls limiting via reinterpretation, right? And in this camp, he puts Rav Hirsch, and others. So, right, he first of all highlights that, right, Rav Hirsch discusses biblical slavery in the context of Korban Pesach. Which is telling, right? He says, the consideration of certain circumstances is necessary correctly to understand the fact that the Torah presupposes it allows the possession and purchase of slaves from abroad to a nation itself just released from slavery. No Jew could make any other human being into a slave, right? So Rav Hirsch, first of all, takes it as a given that the Torah can't really believe in slavery because, right, we discuss slavery and the participation of slaves in the Korban Pesach, which is itself the Korban that we bring celebrating our freedom from slavery. And he just finds it anathema in the Torah system. And he can only acquire it by purchased people who then, by universally accepted international law, were already slaves. So the first Kiddush Rav Hirsch comes up with is that Jews can't make people slaves. They can only buy slaves who are already slaves. Okay? Meaning even Kenani, right? He thinks that a non-Jewish slave is not someone we made into a slave, it's someone we bought who was already enslaved. Right? Now, this seems very unlikely to be true halachically in the sugyas, but this is his first attempt at limiting it. But this transfers into the property of a Jew was the one and only salvation for anybody according to the prevailing laws of the nation with stamps of the slave. The terribly sad experiences of even the last century teach us how completely unprotected and liable to the most inhuman treatment was the slave who, in accordance with the national law, was not emancipated, and even when emancipated, wherever he was, looked upon as still belonging to the slave class or a freed slave. So the first right move that Rav Hirsch makes is that slavery is not an ideal, but we could only buy slaves who were already slaves, and then the Torah laws definitely treat Eved Kenani better than they were treated in other nations, and therefore the Torah's institution of slavery is not an embrace, but it swallows it if and only if they're already slaves, and then we're going to improve their condition. Right? That is Rav Hirsch's first move to try to limit it. This is very problematic, halachically. It's very unclear this is true. Rav Uziel also tries to limit it versus by interpretation, highlighting the fact that, you know, in other nations they could beat their slaves and actively damage them, and we can't, right? Not only that, but if we knocked out a limb, even a tooth, they would go free, right? So that's, you know, Rav Uziel points to that it's more humane than other systems. He also highlights Rav Hertz, like the Hertz Chumash. He argues that the Torah never allowed chaining, maiming, branding, crucifixion of slaves, etc. There could never have been a fugitive slave law. So again, right, all of these thinkers basically think that the Torah, you know, they try to limit it, right? They say it was more merciful. This only goes slightly in the direction of solving the problem, right? First of all, it's not clear that all those halachic claims are true. But also, as Rai Shmalo notes, I think most people would find a problem with this still, because the fact that you're allowing the purchase of slaves, even in a kinder way, you are encouraging the continuation of the institution. Just like we don't allow people to buy stolen goods because it encourages theft, right? So, you know, if we really didn't like slavery, we shouldn't allow the buying of slaves. I mean, you could distinguish and say they're going to remain slaves and at least they'll be better off under us, but, like, it really is problematic. And as he says, Rav Hirsch's claims don't seem to be halachically true, because halacha does seem to allow Ger Toshav to at least sell himself into slavery if he wants. But this is the first basic approach, right? It's to try to limit it as much as possible and maybe at least soften it, if not eliminate the problem. Okay? Approach two is what he calls the moral and social justification approach. So here he highlights people like Venetziv. Now, how do they do that? Venetziv, and again, this definitely will create problems for most modern thinkers, believes that the institution of slavery was to the benefit of the people who were slaves, because they were, it helped them become more moral people. Right, they were dealing with people in immoral nations, amongst idolaters, and taking these people as slaves helped them go towards monotheism. Right now, obviously, from a modern perspective, this is quite problematic because we value autonomy and people's rights to make moral decisions, rather than a super paternalistic view that would say, okay, take them from bad nations and enslave them, and that's the only way that they'll be believed in God. A lot of people would therefore find this problematic, and Nitziv similarly explains that with Cham, right? That Cham is like morally decrepit and therefore needs the support of Shem and Yefet, and that's how he justifies it. Rav Kook as well goes in this direction. And he highlights the fact that in a certain sense slavery is better than certain things we call not slavery, but are slavery. So, like, he highlights that, like, certain minimum wage workers in coal mines are treated worse than slaves, because by slavery, at least the master has a vested interest in their slaves surviving, which, as we know, is not always the case with people's employees. Right, this is one of the arguments that historians have made about the quasi-slavery that emerged post Emancipation Proclamation, that in many ways the quasi-slavery that was recreated in the South was worse than slavery, right? I don't know how much you know the history, but that one of the things that would happen was they created essentially debt slavery, right? You go to prison and then you could work off your debt, and what that meant was that a lot of the blacks who had been slaves now became essentially debt slaves to their old plantation owners, but now it was worse, because before, slavers were very expensive, so they at least wanted to keep them alive. But now, they were basically paying the state minimal, like pennies, to get these debt slaves to work for them, and if one of them died, they just got more from the prison system, so it was actually worse than the original slavery. So Rav Kook highlights this type of thing to say that merciful slave laws might actually be better to take care of these slaves physically than really bad working conditions, because at least slaves, their masters had to take care of them and had a monetary vested interest in taking care of them, which is not necessarily the case in quasi-slavery. Now, as Reishmalo notes, the logic, therefore, would probably not be to encourage slavery, but rather to encourage a social welfare net that would prevent people from falling into that situation. So it might be a little bit disingenuous to say that that is a justification. Rav Dessler also takes a sort of a spiritual one, right, that it allows less spiritually perfected people to help spiritually perfected people. So that's number two, right, which is to say that slavery actually took care of the people in ways that other systems might not have. Again, it has its problems. The third approach is celebrated most in the modern world by Rabinovich, which is the historical accommodation approach, right? Building on Rambam, who says the Torah never wanted karbanot, but it had to give into it because people weren't extricated enough from Avodah Zarah. So he says the same is true of slavery. And the Torah actually wanted slavery to be eliminated, but it couldn't. So you're right. The Torah allowed it, but the Torah never embraced it. Right, and the Torah really would celebrate a world in which slavery would be eliminated. Rabinovich believes this about a lot of things, about polygamy, right, where he says the Torah allowed polygamy, but all the stories in the Torah tell you that polygamy didn't work out, which tells you that Chirim Deren Gershom is not just a technical takana, but actually a moral leap forward in the history of the world. And Rabinovich argues the same thing is true about slavery. Rav Goren as well believed this, and even went as far as to argue this is why Jews were always involved in worldwide emancipation movements. I don't know if that's actually true, But Rav Gurin, like Rav Rinovich, believes that the Torah fundamentally opposed slavery and really wanted it to be eliminated, right? So these are basically the three approaches that have been taken, right? One is to limit it, which again softens the problem, doesn't eliminate it. The second is to explain that slavery was actually better physically or spiritually for the slaves, which again is an attempt to justify it. It may not work, right? But that's an attempt. And the third is to say the Torah never really wanted slavery and therefore would celebrate a world without it, but it recognizes the people in the time of the Torah couldn't swallow that pill, and therefore we had to slowly ease them out of a world in which slavery was rampant by introducing kinder slavery, but hoping that eventually slavery would be eliminated. What Shmuel notes is that the reason that more than maybe other mitzvot, you have so many approaches trying to at least limit or eliminate the problem is because of the deep-seated moral belief that slavery is wrong. And the fact that even rabbis who are not usually apologists in many ways share that moral view, right? And instead of, you know, overcoming their moral view and saying, well, the Torah said it must be fine, they're so convinced that this really is, that the moral opposition to slavery is right, right? That's what drives their conviction that there has to be a way of dealing with the problem. And for anybody who shares the discomfort with slavery, it's at least important to see the range of opinions and get a feeling. At least take comfort in the fact that many, many great thinkers, even who are not usually apologists, share that discomfort. And to survey the ways in which they mitigated that problem. Does it eliminate it? I don't know. Does it mitigate it? I think it's definitely helpful to explore it. Okay, so let's stop there.